Welcome to the GMAT Strategy Podcast. You're here because you believe there's a better way to study for the GMAT, and so do I. I created the GMAT strategy to maximize your results and minimize your efforts so you can get to the fun parts about business school and life as quickly as possible. My name is Isaac Puglia, and I've been teaching GMAT classes and tutoring privately for the GMAT for over 6 years, and I personally have achieved a 99th percentile score on an official GMAT exam and helped hundreds of students get into the business schools of their choice. I'm excited to be a part of your MBA journey since I think the world can benefit from the best possible business leaders that we can find. And if this show is bringing you value, please share it with your friends and family who are studying for the GMAT so that together we can make this process as easy and painless for as many people as we possibly can. Let's go. Let's talk about sentence correction questions. Last week, I addressed the big picture of GMAT verbal, and I want to dive deeper into some of the specific content areas and talk about strategy and how to move your score. To recap, sentence correction tests grammar. Like I said last week, the GMAT really makes the rules of that grammar, so it's probably not sufficient to just study generic grammar resources in English. You want to learn your content from a reputable GMAT-focused source. If you're in the market for some books, I strongly recommend the Manhattan Prep verbal books, specifically the sentence correction one I think is fantastic. It's a little dense. It doesn't always do a great job of prioritizing what's most important to know, but it'll give you basically every tool that you need to hit a super top score with sentence correction. I haven't personally tried out any digital classes that deal with GMAT verbal, but from my time on the forums and in the industry, I hear that the Magoosh verbal videos are pretty good. There's rumors that Target Test Prep is going to be coming out with a verbal class next year in 2020. I've heard fantastic things about their quantitative class, and so I'm very, very hopeful that their verbal class is going to be equally good, if not better. That would be awesome because it's a little bit of a gap in the industry, in my opinion. If you're in the market for an in-person class, I strongly recommend the Manhattan Prep in-person classes. I think that Manhattan Prep just does such a rigorous job screening its instructors that it's almost comical, but you're virtually guaranteed to get someone who's very, very good and very committed to their job if you take a Manhattan class. I have heard some people have had poor experiences at Manhattan. Every instructor I've met from Manhattan Prep has been really, really good. If you're in the San Francisco Bay Area and are in the market for an in-person class, I strongly recommend Test Crackers. They're a very, very small organization, but they use a lot of Manhattan Prep's materials. And if you want to take an in-person class with me, I am teaching Test Crackers classes in San Francisco. So check out the schedule at testcrackers.org if you're in the market for an in-person GMAT class. Let's get into the strategy behind sentence correction, because yes, step one is you do need to know the material super, super well. I addressed that last week, but I wish that was enough. I wish it was enough to just study the stuff and then you get a great performance on sentence correction, but it's just not. That's the truth. There is a lot that goes into getting credit for it, and I'm really hopeful that this podcast is going to make a big difference for you. I meet tons of people who are very frustrated, so I just want to say that it's totally okay if you're in that boat and you've studied sentence correction a lot and you're just like, how do I move the score? I don't understand this. That's super, super common. It's common across all GMAT content areas, hence the podcast. But sentence correction is one of the places I hear about it the most, so just a little solidarity there for all of us who've struggled with sentence correction. So let's get into the process. Let's keep this simple. I think the first thing you should do is just read the sentence. Now, there's disagreement out there. Some people think you should scan the answer choices first. I really don't have a super strong opinion about that. I think if you really like scanning the answers first, that's completely fine. There's very little downside. I personally read it first, and I think that's fine too. So when I read it, I'm just looking for anything that might jump out at me, and I recommend that you do the same. I think part of the advantage of reading is you can't get a grasp on the meaning. We'll talk about meaning later. Meaning tends to be an important decision-making factor, especially as you get into harder sentence correction questions. So that's part of the reason I like to read the full sentence. Now, quick tip, a lot of people get intimidated if the entire sentence is underlined. I think that's very understandable. But I want to help you flip that if that is an issue for you. If the entire sentence is underlined, just think they're probably testing a structural issue, something like modifiers, parallelism, or meaning. And if you are a little intimidated by sentences that are completely underlined, then that can help give you some leverage in that situation, because it's almost like now that you know that, the test is giving you a hint about how you should approach the sentence if the entire thing is underlined. So you're thinking, okay, I'm looking for some modifiers, some parallelism, or some meaning. Automatically, that narrows the field of options and just gives you a more strategic approach rather than getting caught in the emotional aspect of fear. So you've probably familiarized yourself with the format of sentence correction. If you haven't, then answer choice A is always going to be exactly the same as whatever is previously underlined. That's worth knowing. But B, C, D, and E will all be different ways of replacing the underlined portion. The main tactic that we're going to use for giving you leverage on sentence correction is using the differences of each answer choice. And I said last week, but I'll repeat it here because it's so important, there's always a difference at the beginning of each answer choice, and there's always a difference at the end of each answer choice. Now, the important thing here is that's not always a grammatically significant difference. Sometimes it's just a difference that doesn't really make the sentence better or worse. So it's up to you to use your knowledge to differentiate. And that's what I want to get into in a moment. But first, I really want to make an important point that I see a lot of people messing up a lot, which is you don't ever want to eliminate any verbal answer choices unless you're 100% certain that they are wrong. And on sentence correction, that means it violates a known grammatical principle that you are familiar with. If you just don't like an answer choice on your first pass through the answers, that's fine. You can note that. You can give a little minus next to that answer choice on your scratch pad. You can give it a wave, you can give it a question mark, you can give it a frowny face. I mean, you can just give it a down arrow. I mean, whatever makes you feel good, but don't get rid of it. I think being in the habit of getting rid of possibly correct answers that you're not 100% sure about is a very slippery slope, and I see it get people into a lot of trouble, because anytime you're eliminating a right answer and you're spending time choosing amongst wrong answers, you're in for a world of pain, because it's probably going to take a long time and you're just investing a lot of time in being wrong at that point. So please just take my advice and don't eliminate answers that you don't like unless you're 100% sure that they're wrong, grammatically wrong or logically wrong or wrong in terms of reading comp. You'll thank me for that later. You don't have to pick it. You don't have to pick that answer if you don't like it, but just leave it in. Now, about 50% of the time, you can probably eliminate one or two sentence correction answer options just based on that first difference, or in the rare case, that later difference. If it's a really, really hard question, you might only be able to eliminate one or two based on that. But about half the time, you ought to be able to do that. Somewhere around 10 to 20% of the time, you're going to be able to eliminate three wrong answers, which is really, really powerful. That gives you a lot of leverage. You got a 50-50 shot right off the bat if you can get good at recognizing what differences are significant and what are not. It's very rare to eliminate all four just based on one difference at the beginning or the end, but I've seen it happen every once in a while. So because you're probably going to have to scan once and then eliminate one or two options most of the time, then you'll have to scan again. So I would recommend starting by scanning the beginning of each answer choice. Start with that. If you can eliminate, great. If you don't like something, you can note that, but keep it in the running. And then go to the end of each answer choice, scan again for the ones that you have not yet eliminated, and find any significant differences, and then eliminate based on what you know 100%. In many cases, you'll have to repeat that for the middle of the sentence. That gets a little bit harder. But again, the key there is using the differences. You really want to focus on what the differences are. And it's a very important point to make that I see people mixing up a lot as well. Don't try to find the perfect version of the sentence. That's not what sentence correction is about. It's not about reading a sentence saying, oh, this is the way that I think it should be written, and then going and searching for that in the answer choice. It's about finding the best version of what you're presented with. And that might mean the least bad of five bad options, and that's fine. I think you should make your peace with that as soon as possible, because as you get into harder and harder sentence corrections, one of the ways they make them hard is by making the right answer sound wrong, and they're very, very good at doing that. And it's probably a good time to make the point that the GMAT itself is not really about perfection. It's about just getting the best possible performance we can within the constraints. And that's a good approach to have on the verbal section at large, particularly on sentence correction as well. So again, I'll just reiterate, if you're down to two answer choice options, you want to use the differences. Even if they're not significant at that point, if you have to use intuition to guess, that's fine. You just want to make sure that you've exhausted your grammatical knowledge before you let intuition take over. That's my strongest advice with sentence correction, unless, of course, you're already getting tons of sentence correction questions right without any knowledge. Some people are just amazingly, naturally, intuitively good at sentence correction. That's way less than 1% of all GMAT test takers. If you're in that group, then you're very lucky. You should be happy about that, and you don't need to really worry about any of this stuff. But for the rest of us, that brings us to the all-important question, what is a significant difference? How do I get good at recognizing this stuff? So let's get tactical and let's get specific. You might need to study some content if you haven't started studying verbal content for the rest of this episode to make sense, but if you haven't yet studied this stuff, give it a go and then come back when you've learned that so that this stuff makes a little more sense to you. Because what I'm going to talk about is very strategic, very tactical, and I'm not necessarily going to fill in all the content gaps if you're not familiar with that. Although, you can let me know if you would like me to do that in a future episode. I haven't decided how much content I'm going to include in the podcast, but if you're really hungry for it, let me know, and maybe I can do some future episodes on like, what is subject-verb agreement? What is parallelism? Something like that. So you can always reach out to me on Instagram at the GMAT Strategy, YouTube, Facebook, and Reddit, all at the GMAT Strategy or /the GMAT Strategy. Feel free. So there are a few different content areas. I mentioned these in last week's episode. Let's get into the first one, which is the most commonly introduced first amongst materials I've seen, which is subject-verb agreement. Now, the basics of subject-verb agreement are pretty straightforward. Singular subjects go with singular verbs. Plural subjects go with plural verbs. That's probably not a revelation for most of us on the podcast. But like I said before, it's usually not enough to know that, because if it was, everyone would know that and everyone would be getting great results on subject-verb issues, which is often not the case. So here's what you're looking for in the answer choice differences. If you see a difference of singular versus plural nouns, then your job is to go find the verb that helps you differentiate whether you should have a singular or plural noun. So if the first two answer choices are cat and C, D, and E are cats with an S, then chances are you need to find a verb because you're being tested on subject verb and that'll be the key differentiator. Likewise, if you see a difference of singular versus plural verbs, like the first two answer choices are has, H-A-S, and C, D, and E are have, H-A-V-E, then chances are you need to find a noun because they're testing you on singular versus plural verbs. And that might seem really basic, but it's worth having it in the front of your mind. That's what's going to make a big difference when you're on the test because it can be very stressful. And if you don't have something to hang on to intellectually, that can be really troublesome. So I think this type of thing makes your life a lot easier. Now, that's not the only way you're going to be tested on subject verb, but I would say 99.99999% of the time, that's going to be the main issue that allows you to notice, oh, I'm being tested on subject verb. And then that allows you to get credit for your subject verb knowledge. Next up is pronouns. The main way to recognize pronouns is to memorize the ones that are most commonly tested. These are words like that of, those of, their, they, them, and it. So that of, those of, their, they, them, and it. If you ever notice any of those words, it's time to go find a noun in the sentence that that pronoun refers to. That's how you get credit for pronoun errors, because that's what pronouns do. They replace nouns. Next up, we've got parallelism. And for parallelism, you'll want to study a little bit about what parallelism is, but the main thing that's going to help you get credit for this is memorizing what I'm going to call trigger words, which are the words that create a parallel structure in the sentence. For example, phrases like either A or B. That either or sets up A and B to be on the same level logically in the sentence, and so those A and B, whatever A and B is, needs to be parallel, or the same part of speech, basically. Similarly, phrases like not only A but also B, or both A and B, you're gonna want to have a list or some flashcards or something like that to just make sure that those types of phrases are jumping off the screen at you when you read sentence correction questions that contain them. Now, you'll probably need quite a bit of repetition before this type of thing becomes second nature, and I've seen plenty of instruction out there about how to make that happen. If you're interested in cutting down on the amount of time that it takes you to develop this type of pattern recognition, specifically for sentence correction, but also for math and the other parts of the GMAT, then I would recommend checking out my class called the GMAT Strategy, where I've got some really, really simple but really powerful tactics that I haven't really seen other people teaching in the industry that have made a tremendous difference for my students. Now, there's no content in the GMAT Strategy class. I'm not going to teach you what the area of a rhombus is. I'm not going to teach you how to do combinatorics questions or anything like that. The class is just test taking and study strategies that are specifically optimized for the GMAT. So if you're interested in supercharging the preparation that you're already doing, the class plugs easily into any type of content study you're doing. So if you're learning from books, it'll help you leverage those books to the utmost degree. If you're taking an in-person class or you're working with a private tutor, it'll help give you an edge over other people who are doing that same thing. I've got it on sale right now. It's less than $100, which I think is a very good price for the amount of value that it can get, because it can save you a significant amount of time and energy. It's not for everybody, though. I recognize that. So I have a money-back guarantee if you take the class and you decide you don't like it. But I think it's worth a test drive, in my opinion. So reach out to me if you have questions about that. If you're interested in the class, just head to thegmatstrategy.com and scroll down the page to right beneath the video to get your coupon code. Moving on, let's talk about modifiers. So modifiers are kind of a confusing topic I've noticed amongst folks, but the main key with modifiers is recognizing that they just describe things. Modifiers describe things. It could be a single word describing something like an adjective, or it could be a whole phrase. Now, the key to recognizing modifiers on sentence correction questions is training yourself to notice opening dependent clauses. Anytime a sentence starts with a dependent clause, like running down the street, or with the end of the year financials in mind, or something like that, or renowned for her skilled negotiating, all of those dependent clauses need to be followed with a noun. And whatever that noun is that comes right after that dependent clause, it has to make sense as the object of that description. So whatever is describing that noun has to go with that noun. Let me give you an example. So if I said, running down the street, the tree was struck by Peter. That would be wrong on the GMAT because that makes it sound like the thing running down the street is the tree, which is illogical in the eyes of the GMAT. Instead, we'd have to fix it or change it by saying, running down the street, Peter struck the tree. Now, Peter is the thing next to running down the street. So that's getting deeper into what modifiers are, but it's hard to separate that from how you notice them. The most common type of modifier you'll see tested on the GMAT is an opening descriptor like that, that uses an ing word or describes some type of noun. So a lot of that is just training yourself to notice that stuff, and that's why using the differences are so important. So the big differentiator when it comes to noticing differences and noticing modifiers better, beyond just training yourself to spot opening dependent clauses, is if you look at the first difference of each answer choice and you notice different types of nouns. For example, maybe A and B has the editor at the very beginning, and C, D, and E has the author. Those are two different people that probably have different agency in a certain situation. I should go back to the beginning of the sentence and check, does what opens the sentence more logically describe the editor or more logically describe the author? And if you can make a good decision there, you can get rid of either two or three answer choices. That gives you a lot of leverage on questions that test opening modifiers. Again, you want to practice that until it's just jumping off the screen at you on test day. Last couple here, we've got verb tense up next. A good tip here is if you're a native English speaker or you've been speaking English for more than 10 years in a native environment, then you can probably go on sound about 90% of the time with verb tense. And I wouldn't recommend studying a lot of verb tense content because verb tense in English is actually really, really complicated. And you can really sandbag your studies. If you get deep into the intricacies, you can actually make yourself worse if you already have a good intuitive use of verb tense. And most native English speakers are going to be more than fine with that. There's a few tenses you should learn, but those are all highlighted in most of the good materials that I've seen out there, certainly in the materials that I recommended at the beginning of the episode. Now, if you're an English language learner, then this is likely going to be a really, really difficult area. So don't worry about needing a lot of time with English verb tense. I'd strongly recommend Manhattan Prep's Foundations of Verbal book. It's expressly written for English language learners, and that can give you a huge advantage as you're starting out with English verb tense, which can be really, really difficult and thorny. Okay, so have compassion with yourself and allow yourself to not be so great at that for a while. Eventually, you'll get there if you stay in the game. Now, if you see tense shifts between answer choices, like was, were, am, that kind of thing between answer choices, then one important tip is to make sure to check the meaning of the overall sentence. meaning and verb tense cannot really be separated. So you're going to have to be thinking pretty intentionally about a sequence of events. Sometimes you have time markers to help you with that in the sentence, words like before or after, but you don't always have those. So I find that if you notice differences of verb tense in the answer choices, checking the meaning of the sentence can be really, really valuable, especially if you're down to two answer options, where you can get sometimes too nearsighted, too myopic on just the one word difference, and you forget about the global aspect of the sentence. Finally, we've got idioms. Idioms are less and less commonly tested every single year, which is a good thing for everybody. Idioms don't really have a concrete rule, but the main way to notice that idioms are being tested is if you see differences of prepositions. So if A, B, and C have on and D and E have under or at, then chances are you're being tested on idioms. Now, if idioms are a strength for you, like if you're a native speaker, you can probably go on sound with idioms a lot, much like verb tense. If you're an English language learner and you struggle with idioms, that could be a good question to skip or just make a quick decision on if you're not sure. But the main thing with idioms is just making sure that you keep track of the ones that you miss on practice exams and in practice questions. So if you're missing a lot of idioms, you just want to track that very intentionally, and that'll help tremendously. The important thing to discuss after those content areas is the idea of meaning and concision. And this is a really big issue. It definitely goes beyond the scope of this particular episode. Sadly, I would love to go into the intricacies of this, but it's just such an enormous topic that chances are you should get a source that specifically deals with content to help you with this. But like I said, in the future, I may do a little bit more on this type of thing. There's a lot of strategy involved in making meaning and concision decisions. I recommended my class in the middle of the episode a moment ago. I have some really good tactics if you have already covered the basics of sentence correction and you're trying to get more hard questions right. And I think it's mostly in the harder sentence correction questions where you deal with meaning and concision issues a lot. So if you have some books, I would go back and review the meaning section of those books. If you have some in-person class materials or digital class materials, I'd strongly recommend reviewing the meaning and concision aspects of those. If your class has not covered meaning and concision, then I think the GMAT strategy can fill in that gap very, very well. But again, you're unlikely to start confronting significant meaning and concision differences and like a need to make decisions based on that unless you're hitting at least above 650 level sentence correction questions pretty consistently. So that would be like 36 subscore in the verbal and above. So if you're really trying to take it to the top level, meaning and concision usually is the main decision factor that I find myself and I find coaching students on top scores on the most when it comes to sentence correction. Now, there's other little details like subjunctive mood and verb tense, but I'm assuming that all of you are going to be very thorough with your content study. I think that hopefully goes without saying how important that is. And I've actually said it multiple times in last week's episode and this week's episode. So make sure you dot all your I's and cross all your T's with your content study. But I think this strategy should help you make good decisions and start to get credit for the knowledge that you've built. And as always, my greatest hope is that this material will make your studies as easy and as painless as possible. If you want more tips and strategies for optimizing your performance on the GMAT, just head to thegmatstrategy.com and check out my 45-minute video presentation on how to achieve your goal score in half the normal time and with half the normal effort. In the meantime, this is a weekly show, so please subscribe, and as always, stay positive and stay consistent with your studies. I'll talk to you soon.